The final legal steps to legalizing same-sex marriage are likely to take place narrowly or broadly during the current term of the U.S. Supreme Court. But the journey to declare laws against gay marriage unconstitutional discrimination took their biggest legal steps in the 2010 case of Hollingsworth v. Perry. The 2010 Supreme Court decision that overturned California's Proposition 8, which had banned same-sex marriage under statewide ballot measure. Hollingsworth v. Perry was quite literally a court case where life, love, and marriage were on trial. Witnesses were called. Points about love, feeling, being gay, and being married had to be proved in open court.
What if someone were to say, well, you've just chosen at one point in your life to be with a man, and now you've chosen at another point in your life to be with a woman. Couldn't you choose to be with a man again?
When I met Chris and fell in love with her, it was actually the first time I could even identify with the phrase, being in love. And at 37 years old, I discovered something about myself that I hadn't known before. But I can't change who I am. I simply am who I am.
And that is a lesbian.
That is a lesbian.
That's Attorney Ted Olson questioning one of the plaintiffs, Sandy Steer. They're from the HBO documentary, The Case Against Eight. This trial, Hollingsworth v. Perry, was a landmark for many reasons, and its courtroom drama may stand as a peak of jurisprudence for decades to come. Kenji Yoshino, constitutional law professor at New York University School of Law, has captured that in his remarkable new book, Speak Now, Marriage Equality on Trial, that's out today. This was a case where brilliant lawyers, passionate clients, and rational judges brought the clarity of the law together with its humanity and, in a way, with its poetry. Kenji, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks so much, John. It's great to be with you.
You really capture what it was like in that courtroom, and you discovered it even in just reading the transcript. It all came out and came to life for you in this narrative that you tell. It's quite a story.
Thanks so much. That's exactly right. I sort of started reading the transcript and, you know, had kept my distance from the trial because a lot of the movement lawyers had been against it. But once I started reading the transcript, I kind of fell into it. And I had the experience that I think a lot of readers have, maybe the experience that defines us as readers, of turning the first page and not surfacing into everyday life until I'd finished the 3,000-page transcript sort of some days later.
And you allude to this, that the movement for gay rights was really concerned that this would create bad law, bad precedent, and you were a part of that and were hesitant. But when it was a successful case and you were able to look into the transcript itself, what did you see that Ted Olson and Boyce, his co-counsel, did in this case?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, in fairness, at the time when the case was brought, the objection really wasn't on my part or on the movement group's parts against any of the merits claims. It was rather just on timing. Only four states, it's hard to remember this, John, had same-sex marriage at the time. So I think we thought it was a really risky proposition. But the game changer for me, exactly as you said, was just engaging with the trial. So what they gave us that had never happened before, except for a minor state trial in Hawaii long before marriage was on the national consciousness, 14 years before this trial, there had never been a full trial on all of the issues. So what Chief Judge Von Walker did was to really give the nation the privilege of having every single issue vetted. And so we had 12 days of testimony, 8 lay witnesses, 9 expert witnesses. So every claim that the other side made about whether gay people were bad parents, whether this would negatively affect opposite sex marriage, whether this would hurt religious liberties, was just raised and then completely destroyed and debunked in a way that is just not possible in a referendum context or even in an academic debate where a smart person can pivot or avoid the question.
Or even on a radio show. I mean, you are a person with irrepressible optimism, and your reputation in coming through law school as a very talented law student, I think, is consistent with that. Nevertheless, it seems to me in this book you found yourself really astounded that the courtroom was a place for judges to really think about love. What is it? Marriage. Happiness. What is it? And that's what you found here.
Yeah.
Is the courtroom a good place for that?
Yeah, it was extraordinary. So, I mean, thank you for understanding the book so well, because I really thought of trials as being, you know, just I didn't really have any strong priors about whether trials were a good thing or a bad thing. But the thing that really struck me about this trial was just the sheer humanity of it, that these were not sort of platonic abstractions dueling with each other. And as David Boies said, papers talk past each other. You really need human beings confronting each other in order to understand the full stakes of what's going on. So it's not just really moving testimony by the individual plaintiffs, as we heard from Sandy Steer earlier in the clip that you played, but it's also, when we're talking about the question of immutability, you and I can go back and forth about whether sexual orientation is immutable or not as a characteristic. But when you get Ryan Kendall, who was a young man, 26 years old at the time, who had gone through conversion therapy, going through the harrowing experience of that, and testifying on the stand that his mother had said to him, as an evangelical Christian herself, that she would have rather have had an abortion than have a gay son, sent him into conversion therapy, and he became so depressed under the kind of rigors of the conversion therapy that he decided that he was going to commit suicide and ultimately had to emancipate himself from his parents. And so when he gave this testimony on the stand, it really brought to life what the real stakes are, what the lived stakes are of becoming homeless, becoming a drug addict because you had gone through this conversion therapy. And I think that's different in kind from having these very abstract academic debates. And I think the beauty of the trial was that it didn't just do that. It also created not just narrative compassion, but what Elaine Scarry up at Harvard calls statistical compassion, where 2 days after he testified, again, I think you and I and many of the listeners here as smart people would say, okay, that's really moving, but I can't make policy based on one moving story, so show me the data. 2 days later, Boies and Olson brought forward a psychology expert, Gregory Herrick, who just brought out all his charts and studies and said, you know, 92% of people can't change their sexual orientation. So it was a 1-2 punch, you know, both the narrative and the data that made for such a powerful presentation that was unprecedented in our nation's history.
Information, truth, and passion for the law trump all the ideology that we find infecting our government. Kenji Yoshino, thank you so much for this book and for really selecting this issue as a way of giving us all an optimistic view of our own government. Thanks, Kenji.
Thanks, Sean.
Kenji Yoshino is constitutional law professor at New York University School of Law and author of Speak Now, Marriage Equality on Trial.